Hey everyone, it's Stacia. So on its surface, the episode you're about to hear is for a smallish slice of the population. People who want to be symphony cellists. And I guess people who want to judge people who want to become symphony cellists. But on a deeper level, it's about the triumph of the human spirit in the face of adversity and the movie Flashdance. But seriously, you're going to learn a lot about the cello, the makeup of the cello section, important pieces of music for the cello, how the instrument fits into the orchestra, and the inner workings of symphony orchestras, which is particularly interesting, and also the movie Flashdance. And there's a bonus surprise for you at the end of this episode that involves me singing, and also Eyes of Tigers. So stay tuned for that if you dare. Don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review Classical Classroom wherever you listen, and that we love you. On with the show. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the Classical Classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, here. I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
music. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and today's episode is for you aspiring symphony cellists out there. Joel Dallow, my guest, has been a member of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra's cello section for over 20 years. So long, in fact, that he is now one of the people who sits on the panel that listens to cello auditions. And he's going to give us the inside scoop on what it's like to be on that side of the table, and he's going to give you some advice, hopefully, for you would-be symphony cellists out there. Joel, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan.
So, thank you. A few more things about you. That's your day job, but by night, you're Batman. Just kidding. You're the cello Sherpa, which I want to get into a little bit. And so you're a teacher, and you're also the host of the Cello Sherpa podcast, which is very cool. I listened to a little bit of that, even though I myself am not a cellist. And you are also the artistic director and founder of the Riverside Chamber Players. So got a lot going on, man.
I do. And the pandemic made me think about what I want to do with my time, which is where the Cello Sherpa was born.
Okay. Well, tell me, you know what? Actually, no, don't tell me about that yet. I want to start at the very beginning of Joel, because as it turns out, you're one of triplets. You're the second of triplets. I've never met. What do you call someone who is part of a triplet? I know you call a twin. Do I call you a triplet?
Yep, just triplet. That works great.
And are your siblings also musical?
Well, everybody played something growing up because our parents were musicians. So it was sort of part of our education. It was a requirement that everybody played an instrument.
Oh, I gotcha. I'm going to ask you the annoying questions. Are you identical?
We're not identical. There's actually three of us.
Uh-huh.
I mean, three separate eggs is what I should say. We're fraternal is what they call it.
Okay.
So it's myself and my two sisters. Uh-huh. I was the middle child. Uh-huh. And we have a sister that is 2.5 years older. So her life came to a rocking shock. And then, of course, we were triplets before it was popular to be a triplet. And back then, believe it or not, they did not have ultrasound.
Oh.
So we were, everywhere we went, we were the first triplets. First triplets, wow, in the school, first triplets born in that hospital. And they were able to see that there were at least three by x-ray and heart rate. So put the stethoscope there and listened. And the doctor turned to my father and said, well, we know there's at least three.
At least three. Oh my God. Maybe they were relieved when only three came out.
I think so.
Well, that's crazy. So how did this lead you to become a cellist?
Well, both of my parents were pianists. They met in college. And my father's also a composer. And my mother's also a writer. And she had a duo with a cellist when I was growing up. His name was Myron Lutsky. He's a cellist in New York. And so from before I remember, apparently they would rehearse at the house. And I was incredibly drawn to the instrument. The stories are I used to sneak down at 2 years old when they were rehearsing and listen to them at the top of the steps. And I do remember telling him I wanted to play, but my parents said, oh, you're too little, you're too little. And at 5 years old, they finally told me I could start on the piano. So I started on the piano, which actually is an advantage because if you walk away from a piano lesson, you can actually play a note after that first lesson because you press the key down and a note comes out. Whereas a string instrument is much harder to learn how to draw that bow across and get a decent sound and can be a little demoralizing in the beginning. So piano was great for learning how to play the instrument, learning how to read bass clef and treble clef, and just sort of getting a basic introduction to counting and what comes along with that. So I did that for a year, and then at 6 years old, they finally got me a cello.
Finally.
Finally.
And you stuck with it. And now you are the cello Sherpa. Now, Sherpas are usually people who guide you up a mountain. They're also, I found out, a Tibetan ethnic group. I didn't know that. Like, it's an actual ethnic group. But how are you the cello Sherpa? How do you guide people up cello mountain?
Well, I don't think it's possible to achieve what you want on any instrument without a guide.
Yeah.
But I'm not a sorcerer that can produce magic and make you great. But if you have the tools and you're in the shape to get up that mountain and you have somebody who helps you and shows you the way and helps get you up the mountain, that was the philosophy behind that name.
Yeah.
Lots of time to think during the pandemic.
Tell me a little bit more about playing with the Atlanta Symphony. You've been with them for over 20 years?
I just finished 22 seasons, yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
That's crazy. I'm going to guess you'll like it. Give me the highs and lows. Give me the...
Well, first of all, it's extremely hard to get a full-time orchestra job, which we'll talk more about in a few minutes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So just that journey to get there was a challenge in itself. But when I finally got the opportunity to play with a great orchestra, it was just so rewarding after all the work. It's an orchestra job is great when you play the music you love. You don't always get to play the music you love, but that's part of the group. And you don't, well, let's put it this way. You can't make a sound like that without all the other people. So it's so above and beyond what you can do by yourself. And that's what's so exciting about it. When you have a concert where everybody pulls together and you play a big Mahler symphony or a Strauss tone poem or something that's just enormous and that you cannot produce when you're sitting at home by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that preparing for auditions, and it took me 5 years to land a full-time professional orchestra job. In those 5 years, I also had to learn the repertoire. And while you're taking auditions, a lot of times you're preparing repertoire that you might have never played before. So you have to be able to show when you take that audition that even if you've never played it, you have to sound like you've played it, like you're familiar with the repertoire. So you really have to study it at the same time. So I was lucky enough to be in the Philadelphia area when I was freelancing and taking auditions and raising little kids at the same time. So it was definitely a lot going on. Wow. But I was freelancing and playing in a lot of smaller orchestras and covering some of the rep. And I had a great opportunity to play for a lot of the members of the cello section in the Philadelphia Orchestra. And they helped me a lot. I got the opportunity to sub in there. And that was really what got me to a point where I could learn how to be competitive in an audition process. Because it's much, much more than just, are you a good player? There's a lot of great cellists out there, let me tell you. But winning an orchestra audition isn't always about the best player. It goes to the people that learn how to do their best in a system that is extremely competitive and challenging.
But don't spoil anything yet. We haven't gotten there.
Okay.
Okay. So before we get into all of those finer points of like what it takes to know if you've got it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about first the structure of briefly the structure of a symphony orchestra, where the cello section fits into that. How many cellos are we talking about, and what do they do?
Generally, most orchestras have between 8 and 12, depends on the size of the orchestra. It's obviously the most important member of the string section.
Obviously.
We fit in, obviously, we have the violins. There's two sections of violins that usually each section is as big as the cello section, but typically around 12 violins or so, 12 to 16 per section. And then the viola section is the next largest instrument. And then you have the cellos, which are the next largest. And the biggest one after that is obviously the bass, which really, as my friend Michael Kurth likes to say, is like the pavement in the movie that the main character is walking on. He says that the pavement really, it sets the space for everything else, or the bass sets the pavement that everything else comes off of. So it's really the root of the orchestra. So a lot of times we're going between that role, sharing with the basses of really laying down the foundation, and then swapping into another role. We're in the middle voice, and then we get great, luscious, beautiful melodies too. And we don't have to play as high as the violin. So it's sort of a nice middle of the road voice. It's the closest to the human voice, the cello. So that's why I think most people really enjoy and find the voice of the cello so soothing, because it's the closest to what we're used to listening to in our own voices and people around us.
And we love hearing ourselves talk.
That's right. That's why we start a podcast.
That's right. That's why we start these podcasts. So within a cello section, is there a cello leader? Like, I know, in the violin section, like, there's the, I don't even know what it's called. It's
terrible. The violin, they call it the concertmaster.
The concertmaster, thank you.
Yes, there is. Every string section has a leader. It's called the principal chair. Okay. And there's usually, depends on the size of the orchestra, but usually there's an assistant principal and an associate principal. Actually, associate goes first and then assistant. So you usually have in a cello section or viola or violin, you have at least three title chairs. And the principal is responsible for all of the bowings, making sure that all the bowings match the other string sections.
Yeah.
Playing the big solos when they're there and leading the section to make sure to be that conduit from the cello section to the conductor, which also ties to what the violins and the violas and then the winds and the brass are doing. So the principal cellist is responsible for sort of managing the section, making sure that somebody's not sticking out and playing too loud and that we're really blending as one voice together. And once in a while, the principal will turn around and ask that we pay attention to something here or make sure we don't rush here. So it's a really important role.
Mm-hmm. And does the principal cellist discipline the other people in the cello section by yelling, by
Well, that depends on the principal. Fortunately, we have a great principal who's just very kind, and he leads extremely well by example. He's an exceptionally brilliant cellist.
Yeah.
He plays incredible solos. He does a great job with all the duties that are there, and he'll just turn around, and sometimes he'll come back and walk back if it's not in the middle of a section, and just point something out, and he always does it with, let's do this, let's aim for that. Sort of a collegial style. I don't think it's always been that way in every orchestra. It depends on who's sitting there.
Yeah. Well, so we're going to be talking about auditions. What warrants an audition? Like, what? I'm guessing a cellist retires. A cellist is taking a break. Like, how often are these auditions going down, and why?
Okay, well, to give you an example right now, we had two people in the cello section that had been in the orchestra for nearly 50 years, and both of them decided to retire within the last year. So we actually have two openings.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a little rare. I would say in the 22 years that I've been here, I've been a part of four or five cello auditions. So we've gotten a new principal. We've gotten a new assistant principal. We've hired several section players along the way. But there was a time when I, at 44 or 45, was still the last person to be hired into the section and still the youngest at that point in the section until we just hired somebody a few years ago. So there can be long stretches of 10, 15 years with no opening, or we might have a 1 year opening. If somebody decides to take a sabbatical for a year, then we would hire somebody to fill that 1 year position.
Yeah, because like traditionally in the classical music world, like getting into a symphony orchestra, I mean, it's a huge deal. It's sort of it's the experience that so many young musicians are shooting for when they go to conservatory and all of that. Like, that's the place where you want to wind up. And once you secure one of those jobs, I imagine, like, you know, you don't want to let that go. That's job security, which for musicians can be really hard to come by.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I guess people just, and then you just get to play music. Is that the case? Like,
that is true. I mean, you do see departures for other orchestras, and somebody might move for a title position somewhere else, or a job that pays more, or in a city they'd rather live in. So we've seen a relative amount of turnover in the years I've been here. I've seen multiple brass sections. Many of our brass instrumentalists have ended up in the New York Philharmonic. So it happens where people will move to other places, and that will create an opening also. But it is a job, like you said, it's really hard to find stability unless you have an orchestra job or you get a teaching position at a university or conservatory. It's really tough to find a place where you can count on a paycheck every week and make it as a musician and not be worried about where your next paycheck is going to come from. Freelancing is challenging, but it's a good way to kind of get your feet wet. But it's nice if you can eventually get a job like this.
Yeah. Well, so let's get into the audition now. So take me to the audition. Like, I've seen it in movies, and I imagine that it's exactly like that scene in Flashdance where she's trying out to get into the school. But there's a chance I'm wrong. I can't imagine that I am. But set us up. What does it look like?
Well, the first thing that happens is there's an opening. The opening is posted in the union paper, which is released once a month. And that will show where all the openings are around the country of all the different instruments. And then you send your resume in, and then they will send you back, hopefully a letter accepting your resume, and send you a list of things that you need to learn. It usually requires a solo piece, which would be like a concerto with orchestra. So you can usually pick what you want. Sometimes they specify everything, but a lot of times you get to pick one solo piece, maybe two, which would be a concerto with orchestra. And then probably a movement of Bach is pretty common in the Bach cello suites. Mm-hmm. And then from there, they'll list all of the music that you're expected to learn. And that has changed a bit over the years. Nowadays, if you get a list, it will probably tell you exactly what spots that you need to learn. So you can sort of be laser focused from measure to measure. Mm-hmm. Back even 20 plus years ago when I was taking more auditions, a lot of orchestras would just say Beethoven Symphony No. 5, Movement 2 and 3. Or even just Beethoven Symphony No. 5 or Mahler Symphony No. 4 or Bruckner Symphony 7. They just tell you the whole piece, and you might as well make sure you know all the very typical spots that they could ask, but that doesn't mean they won't ask something that surprises you too.
Oh my God. Wow.
So over the years, the whole process has changed, but then you get that list and you fly to the audition. It's your responsibility to put yourself in a hotel, to pay for your cello travel, whether you drive or fly or whatever that is. If you fly, you probably want to stick it in a seat next to you for the utmost safety. And then you go take the audition. And do you want me to tell you about what that process is like?
Yes. Yeah. I want the full cinematic experience. You walk into the concert hall carrying your giant cello. You've flown from thousands of miles away and paid for two plane seats, and now you are completely broke. And
yes.
you walk into the doors, the giant doors, and then, yeah, what happens next?
Okay, so you get a slot of time usually, which will be an hour, and they'll probably have 6 to 8 people show up every hour, and you'll meet with the personnel department, and they will assign you a practice room and a number. Mm-hmm. So you are not known. It is anonymous.
Okay.
And then you'll go warm up and eventually you'll make your way up to the stage. And when you get to the stage, there'll be somebody on stage. They call them a proctor, but they will lead you onto stage. And the stage will have either the audience will be screened or there'll be a screen in front of the whole stage that you'll walk out so that nobody can see who you are.
Mm.
There'll also be carpeting from the backstage across to wherever you're sitting so that nobody could tell whether you're wearing high heels or regular shoes. Yeah.
Wow. That's so detailed.
Yeah. And the purpose of the proctor is to point out the spots that you'll play if you don't know ahead of time. A lot of times now they'll tell you what spots they want you to walk out and play. But if you have any questions, you are not allowed to speak because you can't give up whether you are a male or female. And so you have to turn to the proctor and ask the question. The proctor will then ask the committee the question. Because otherwise you have eliminated your anonymity, which is very important to the process.
Wow.
So in the first round, you'll play a bit of your solo is generally where an orchestra committee will have you start. So you can get comfortable, feel what the hall is like. And then you'll play 3 to 5 excerpts. You might play for 5 or 6 minutes. It's unaccompanied, American Idol style, unaccompanied. Mm-hmm. And then you walk off and you go back down to the lounge and you wait. And every hour or 2 hours, different orchestras handle it differently. They will announce which numbers advanced to the next round.
Oh, wow. There are more rounds.
Yes.
There
are
my
more
God.
Rounds. The goal is to make it to the final round.
How many rounds are there? And are they all the same? Are they all like... Well, anonymous
well, that is changing actually. So
okay.
A lot of orchestras, what's been typical is that the second round would happen either later in the day or the next day. And that would be the semifinal round. And it would be however many numbers made it through the first round.
Mm-hmm.
So then they show up in another pool and they would then go and play and probably get a little bit more of an opportunity to play than in the first round. So mm-hmm. You might get 5 to 7 minutes in the first round of an audition. In the second, I think it would be safe to say closer to 10, maybe 12 minutes. Depends on the orchestra. It's always a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And then they make another cut down to the final cut from there. So if you're lucky enough to make that round, That's usually where the music director joins the committee and then... Usually the screen comes down and people are able to see your resumes and your experience. But that is changing right now because there's been a lot of pushback with concern of making sure that we hire equitably. So I think the push, at least for the next season, I think we'll see a lot of orchestras that will keep that screen up for all 3 rounds. And
Wow. Yeah,
so you're making a decision without knowing anything about that candidate, which has its own challenges.
Uh-huh.
But some orchestras have done trial periods where you'll get a week trial period. In my experience, when I was hired in Atlanta, I was hired for a 1-year position. And then I was given another 1-year contract until the national audition could happen because the person mm-hmm. that I was replacing for 1 year decided to retire.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
So I had the opportunity to play in the orchestra for 1.5 years after the first audition I took before I had to audition again for the permanent position, which fortunately I ended up with.
Oh my God. You had to go through that again?
Yeah, but it is an advantage because at that point I know how the orchestra plays. I've played a lot more repertoire than before I had the job for 1.5 years. I've learned a lot more of the repertoire. You become more comfortable. It's an advantage, but it's also a double-edged sword because you can be even more nervous if you know you want something really badly and you live there and it's going to make a difference to your life, whether you stay or whether you're moving back somewhere else. It's an extra kind of pressure.
Oh my God. Yeah. I could see where that would be extremely nerve-wracking and like probably rattle you while you're trying to focus. So, So, but you went through all of this. You went through the crazy first audition. You went through another audition, and now you've been there for a long time. And now you are on the panel behind the judges' table, and you're the one who's like listening. You're on the other side of that screen. And so, tell me a little bit about what that's like. How are you feeling from that side of the screen? What does it look like? Give me the lay of the land.
Well, it's the first time I got to do it was pretty exciting because it's taking an audition was not something that came naturally to me. I really had to work at it. Some people right out of the gate, they win a job, no problem. And they go on with the rest of their life. They win more jobs. Other people have to work at it. And I think there's a bit of ignorance is bliss when you first start. You just walk out there and play the audition having never experienced it. And you might get lucky and just win that audition. It can happen. It didn't happen for me that way, unfortunately. I came close in the beginning, and then I spent about a year and a half where I didn't advance out of the first round. So that was pretty demoralizing, I have to say. But then you really have to look at how you're going to go through this process. And if you're going to do it, how you are really going to face what's holding you back. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole search that goes on there. So getting the opportunity to finally be on the other side and listen to all of those people take the same journey that I did was another eye-opening experience to see how people handle themselves on stage. Do people come out and just play right away? Do they just make a lot of noise? Do they take lots of time between excerpts? Do they fiddle with lots of things? I mean, it's funny when you can't see somebody, you wonder sometimes when they're sitting there, what are they doing? Some people will just play and they're pros at it and they're used to the experience. But when you take the visual out of it and you're not distracted by what you're seeing, you really, it just comes down to what you hear. Mm-hmm. And in an orchestra audition, it's not the same as sitting down and playing a symphony. You sit down and play one of the big symphonies that are one of the excerpts that we'll talk about. It's a totally different experience than having to do it on stage. Because when you're doing it on stage, there has to be this really heightened level that's almost above and beyond what's expected on a daily basis. It's a competitive level. It's like a competition. So you're practicing like 3 to 5 hours a day on just these excerpts and really trying to hone that process and playing for lots of people and trying to get yourself nervous so you know what that feels like. And then when you get on the other side of it and you get to hear that, you can hear nerves, you can hear people breathing. Sometimes you can tell from people breathing whether they're male or female, believe it or not.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's very much like an Olympic event. You train and train and train and train, and then you have 5 or 6 minutes, or in some cases, if it's the 40-yard dash, you have seconds that you've trained months and months for. So I think if you sort of put that mindset forward when you're thinking about it, that helps the training process and how to work on the arc of getting there. So we sit back there and you're furiously trying to take notes. And here's the other thing that I found challenging being on the other side is people are playing through a list that usually has been given to them backstage. So they'll just go right through the 5 excerpts. And a lot of times when you're thinking and writing and trying to listen to somebody at the same time, we're human. We're not going to hear everything. We're not going to gauge everything. I don't know how well people can write and listen at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listening is really hard for people. Like, we're not historically great at listening to others to begin with. But like, when your job is to actually sit there and listen, I imagine you do a lot of thinking about listening.
Yeah. And you're listening for hours and hours on end. So, people get tired. People get hungry. Uh-huh. People maybe didn't sleep enough. So there's all these things that because we're human beings on one side and we're fallible, it's you try and do the best that you can. And I think the most shocking thing for me was really trying to absorb what a player was doing quickly, writing it down quickly, and then having them go to the next thing and keeping up that pace and making sure that I didn't miss anything.
Yeah. So this is like a skill. This is like being able to be present and take notes and to listen for the right things, the things that will help you to choose a good player for the symphony, because this is like a major decision not only for the person who's being chosen, but for the symphony, because it's like, you know, this is a group that plays together for a long time. So potentially this person is going to be there for a long time. I'm going to pick somebody who's the right fit. So we'll, let's walk through a little bit of a piece of music where we can hear some of what you're listening for. And if you have one that has a mistake or anything like that that you can point out.
Oh, I can demonstrate the mistake.
Oh, you can.
That's okay. No problem.
Okay. Great. All right. We'll be right back to hear Joel's mistakes. But first, a quick word from our sponsor.
When you fall for opera, you fall hard. It's not really because of the plots or the sets or the spectacle of it all. It's because of these little perfect moments, the arias. I'm Rhiannon Giddens, and Aria Code is a podcast that reveals the magic of opera, one song at a time. You may not understand the words, but I guarantee you'll feel them. Aria Code, from WQXR and the Metropolitan Opera. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts.
And now back to our discussion with Joel Dallow. So Joel, the audition process sounds so challenging for both the musician and for people like you who are on the panel.
I took 25 auditions. This did not come easily for me. It was 5 years of auditioning all over the place. Now, I did win some smaller things in the meantime that I did, but it was a lot. This was not a walk in the park for me. I really, really had to work at that competitive type level because, again, there are so many people that can play the cello extremely well. Hmm. It's an instrument that people love, so a lot of people play it, and a lot of people play it really well.
Yeah. But
when you go to an audition, there's just very specific markers that most committees are looking for. And I think that's really what I can show in an excerpt. And the most common excerpt I would say that shows up on almost every list I've ever played is Beethoven 5. And everybody knows Beethoven 5, but not the spots that we're talking about.
Okay, let's hear that. Let's hear the not the spots.
So this spot shows up on every list. Doesn't really sound very hard, does it?
Right.
If you just listen to it. Yeah.
Seems basic-y.
Yeah, but it shows so much, so quickly. That's why we ask for it. Because we have this rhythm. And that is it's a 16th note, a dotted 16th note to a 32nd note. So you have to play it as it's da-da-da-da-dum. So you have to think of those four notes at once when you're playing it so that you really get that rhythm. And that's the first reason why we ask that, because if somebody comes in and plays, that's not the same as. So we're looking for that. And then that goes through the entire excerpt. And it's not just being able to play that, but you have to, here, I'll go right from the beginning. That's a pickup note. So right away, you can't play. It should be leading to that, because that's the downbeat, and the downbeat is where the emphasis usually goes in a measure. So you think about that, plus the rhythm. It's also in a bit of a funky place on the cello to really get the right kind of sound. You're playing around the neck of the cello, and so it's this warm sound that you can get, and you have to play it there because of the way that it's written, but it creates other problems. So you start, and you really play. You know, but again, always keeping that 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. And then, oh, by the way, make sure it's perfectly in tune, shifting up and down the cello. And don't forget that it's also a piece of music that needs to have a phrase. And the thing about this particular excerpt is that's the theme. And then what's asked for after that is there's a variation and then another variation. So there's this skill of being able to play all three of them. And the first excerpt is 20 seconds. So it's a little tiny snippet, but again, yeah. It shows so much about can you play in tune? Can you play with rhythm? Can you play with phrasing? Don't play too loud. Oh, uh-huh. And then by the way, now play the variation. The variation comes and it's... And you want to still get that same phrase mimicking, obviously, the theme because it's a variation on the theme. And then the next one that comes is 30-second notes. So you're playing all of those little notes that you have to think of so much when you play the theme. And by the way, make sure you play them all the same tempo.
Oh, my God.
So there's a lot, just to give you a snippet of a lot of different things to think about just in this basic excerpt.
Yeah.
And it's funny because a lot of us, we still say, if you sit down and play this in an orchestra, in a section, it's much easier than trying to sit down and play it just like this because there's this laser focus on all these little things. But when you're playing with a whole orchestra and playing with a section and playing with a conductor, there can be a little bit of ebb and flow to it. But you can't really do that in the audition. You sort of have to be really rhythmic and be musical, but without stretching the rhythm in some way that you think some conductor might do it. So you sort of have to play the safe lane going down the middle of the road there as best as you can, especially if you're going for a section position, because a section position is being a team player. You know, it's about being able to do this together with one voice, with 8 to 12 different people doing the same thing.
You have to demonstrate so much in so few notes with that. That's crazy. And like, I'm like nervous. I'm sweating a little and I'm not even auditioning right now as you're telling me this. So what's the most common error that you hear people make when they're playing that particular piece?
I think the biggest thing is the internal rhythm that I was talking about, like really getting da 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 dum, dee 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 da 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 dee dum, really feeling the small notes so that that rhythm comes. And pitch is a big thing too. I mean, sure, in my demonstration, it could be better in tune also. It can always be better in tune. So that's the biggest thing is, and if somebody doesn't display really exceptional intonation and exceptional rhythm, then you're probably not going to make it out of the first round. Even if you play it beautifully phrased and have a beautiful sound, it's just that those are sort of the fundamental things that have to be in place before you can even think about what comes next. And so I think a lot of the mistakes that people make are that they will play musically and beautifully, but they'll miss the little things that are the fundamentals, that are the building blocks that you need to make it up to where you can play with that level of musicianship. It all has to come together. And that's the challenge. And I have been working on this excerpt for probably 30 years now, or at least, let's say, like 28. And it is, it's still challenging. You know, for me to just sit down and demonstrate it perfectly, I was practicing 3 to 5 hours a day for my auditions to be able to play things like this. And still, I would have to, it's this level of competitiveness and this level of being in shape that goes almost above and beyond what's human.
Yeah. This is like preternatural. So say you amazingly make it through this first round, and you're going into the second round. What's a typical piece of music for like a second round audition?
You'll definitely see one of the Strauss tone poems in a second round. You might see him in the first round too. It depends. And that would be, why don't we put up Strauss, Ein Heldenleben, the opening of that.
Okay, so so what are you, take me there, you're a cellist auditioning, what are you doing, what are you focusing on, and then also as a person listening to this, what are you listening for?
Well, the very opening melody that you hear the French horn playing is also along with the cellos. So we play that melody. So what happens is you've got this big sweeping melody. It starts. And then you have to make a shift. Now that shift is an eighth note that's dotted tied to a 16th note. So it's very much the same type of rhythm as we talked about in the Beethoven. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, da da dum. So you play, I should not sing, but. And then it's followed by 4 16th notes. So the thing right away, there's rhythmic things in here. There's triplets in the first measure. It's a huge melody. And you have three big shifts in the first eight measures that are scary. And let me see. So the first one. And by the way, make sure you play those 4 16th notes placed exactly where they need to be. You hold it's a dotted half note to 4 16th notes. So it's you have to have this internal rhythm going at the same time as this giant sweeping melody. And then you have a shift here. And let me tell you, in an audition, that's terrifying. So it's really learning how to stop worrying about the shift when it comes to the audition and move to a place where you can be focusing on the music and be thinking about the phrase and thinking about right. The horn melody that's playing with you. And while you're at the same time, you have to have this internal rhythm on the 16th notes, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, because you're playing da-da-dum. On the shifts, you're playing that same rhythm. Yeah. And then you have to make sure that you have this big sweeping feel to it at the same time. It's kind of encompasses all of the different things that you can imagine asking for are in the first half a page of this excerpt. So it shows a lot really quickly.
Wow.
That's why it's important to study with people that are doing it for a living.
Yeah.
Because they'll really show you the ropes and show you what you need to learn in the repertoire if you haven't played it.
So you amazingly make it through to round three, the final round, and you are nervous as hell. And you're sitting down to play what? Well, first of all, how many other people are you competing with at this point? And then, yeah, what are you sitting down to play?
Generally, it will probably be a handful, between three and seven in the finals. I think I've seen as many. Sometimes if they have too many, they'll just make another semifinal round. It depends on the orchestra. But I would say in that range, when I was in the finals here, I think it was five of us.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time now in most orchestras where the music director joins the panel.
Oh, wow.
This is a challenge. Yeah, imagine. Yeah. So what happens is you have, again, orchestras are all different, but in Atlanta, we have a committee of seven musicians for a section job. And the musicians on the committee are the ones who are listening and advancing the people through majority vote usually. Then the music director comes in. Well, depending on the music director, they might not like any of the candidates that the committee liked. They might be listening for something completely different. It depends. So what happens is because it's the finals and because the music director is there, then you're going to get a chance to play more. You're probably going to play 20 to 25 minutes, a good chance you might play. Yeah, because the music director hasn't heard you play yet.
Yeah.
So now you're going to go back and play your concerto again, maybe play your movement of Bach, and then probably play 7 to 10 excerpts, depends on the list and depends on what they want to hear. And sometimes in a few excerpts, you can tell this is the person. Just from a few things. And then you might ask for some different things just to see how they do things stylistically. That's one of the other reasons why you ask specific pieces is Strauss has a style to it. Debussy has a style to it. Does this person that you're listening to have a sense of those kinds of styles?
Yeah.
And can they come across that way just by themselves?
Yeah. What's a piece that we could listen to that like you remember from a past audition where somebody's played it and you've just gone, that's it. That's the person.
That's a really good question. Yeah. I don't know if it was ever just one excerpt. It probably was still a couple.
Yeah.
But this is the challenge is you have seven personalities And there are different things that I'm listening for in a candidate than other people, mm-hmm. even if the people are in the same section as me. So yeah. I really value somebody who plays with a beautiful sound, great intonation. Obviously, rhythm is important, but sound is really important to me, because if you are playing with a, if you overplay and you push the instrument, it doesn't really matter what you're doing other than yeah. that, because the sound is what everybody hears. So that's the first thing. And I want to hear somebody who plays technically clean and you can hear the little notes, but I also want to hear somebody who plays a beautiful phrase and plays a real melody and plays with color, because that's when people hear the cello section the most. Uh-huh. So if you want, I'll give you an example. If you pick the other Strauss tone poem, just play the very opening. I want to show you something that's interesting about this, because this excerpt is all about technique.
Okay, so this would be Don Juan.
Yes. So this is an excerpt that I really struggled with for most of my auditioning life. I would say it took me 3 years of auditioning before I could play just that little clip without messing up and bombing on stage. And the reason is because it starts out with 7/16th notes in a row. And you have to play, you know, this big sweeping clear, and you have to hear every note.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if you could hear every note when I just played it.
I could not.
Yeah. That's bad. So
that's probably that's the fault of my ears, not your playing.
And the other thing is you're going, so you have four notes on the G string, and then you have two more notes on the next string, and then you have another two notes on the A string. So you don't just have, those are the first seven notes, but you have to cross the string and you have to make sure that your bow and your left hand line up precisely on those changes, or it won't be clean.
Oh my God. It's like tightrope walking.
Yeah. And so I bring this excerpt up as a point because, yes, it's very important to me that somebody can play this. But when you hear the orchestra play that, that's not really where the cello section stands mm-hmm. out. The cello section stands out when you have a big melody. And that is, even the beginning of Strauss does that well. But again, Strauss is there's a lot of technical things in there too. But sometimes it can be just as simple as a Tchaikovsky melody or a Brahms melody or one of the great melodies. And that's where we shine as a section. So I want to sit next to somebody that can shine in the beautiful spots and
yeah.
is a nice, clean player. But some people value cleanliness more. So it just depends on who's listening and what they prioritize as the most important yeah. part of picking a candidate.
Yeah. So that's like if there are two really good players in this like final, for you, it's going to be the person who not only has the technical chops, but the person who has the feeling.
Yeah.
That you're looking for, who has that musicality.
But I should add that at the end, when the choice is made, in our orchestra, it's up to the music director. So you have put all this work in
yeah.
over days of listening to people as a
hours
committee.
Hours and hours.
And you get to the end, and it's up to the music director who came in for the final round.
And the music director comes in and announces the person, like, this is who it's going to be. And then like, what happens?
Well, it depends. Again, in our orchestra, Robert Spano, who's our outgoing music director, actually, he just finished this season after 20 years, and mm-hmm. he is going to be the music director for Fort Worth Symphony. Mm-hmm. But he gave a lot of deference to the committee. So he was very much about trying to make a pick that went along with the majority of the committee also.
Uh-huh.
So some music directors will just pick whoever they want in spite of the committee. Mm-hmm. But I think he really did everything he could to trust the musicians, and he respects and trusts every musician on stage. So he values our opinion, and he would take that into account when he makes his decisions. So usually he wouldn't decide somebody just because he wanted them.
Yeah.
Now, he generally has not hired on the spot. He generally would hire or he would offer one or two or three. We've had as many as seven, actually, believe it or not, because we hired four violinists right before the pandemic. So I think we had seven candidates, and all of them came and played a week in the orchestra. So you could be great at playing an audition by yourself, but does that mean that you can sit on stage with a group of people and blend with them and feel the music with them and follow the music director and follow your colleagues? Because your antenna has to be up. You're not just focusing on what is the conductor doing, but you're paying attention to what's my stand partner doing? What's the principal doing? What's the concertmaster doing? What's the principal violist doing? What's the principal bass doing? And you're kind of pulling all that information in all the time to make sure that you're playing where you should be and playing with people. And so if you put somebody in an orchestra for a week in a trial, you can tell generally pretty quickly whether that person has the ability to play well with other people. And we've done a lot of that, and we've made a lot of really good hires that way. But I will say, again, we're watching a lot of things sort of flex and change in the industry. And a lot of what people are looking at is the audition process. And a lot of orchestras are trying to get away from the trial period because they have felt that that is also a place for bias when it comes to hiring somebody.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And I can see it both ways. I can understand. But what happens is, let's say we didn't have a trial period and we hired somebody, which could happen, then they would go through a probationary period of tenure, which could last as long as two full seasons. So in the first 2 years, you are on probation anyway. So if you're not a good fit and you're not a good colleague and you're problematic in one way or another, particularly if you're in a solo wind or solo brass part where it's really exposed what you're playing, then that becomes obvious. And there's a process of a committee that evaluates what you're doing about three times over 2 years to make that decision.
Wow.
Yeah.
So even when it's over, it's not over.
It's not over.
And you have like no sense of job security at all for a long time.
Well, you do have job security because you'd get a 1 year contract at a time in that process.
Yeah. Yes. But like you kind of don't know what your ultimate fate is. This is crazy.
It's lunacy. It's a tough process because I've always said that one of the things about the audition process is it's not totally geared for picking somebody who's necessarily the right colleague in an orchestra. I mean, in an ideal world, we would go out and find a bunch of people that were qualified and then have them come play in the orchestra for weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. Because then you would have a way of finding... Because the person that can sit down and play the cleanest on stage and the most perfectly in tune and the perfect rhythm isn't necessarily the person that is going to fit into the orchestra in this living, breathing organism of art in the way that everybody needs them to. Mm-hmm. So you really, but how else do you go through this process without whittling it down through some sort of competition?
Right.
Because then you'd be leaving. How would you make sure that enough people had access, enough people were allowed to come play, enough people were allowed to apply like a regular job and go sit in the orchestra? So there's a lot of room for improvement. And I think we really are in a time of purposeful change right now and looking at how we can do this better. Mm-hmm. But until that happens, I will continue to coach through my own experience.
Oh, that was an amazing
and the way that segment. I'm used to it.
Yeah. So it's like just because Jennifer Beals danced really well in front of that panel doesn't mean that she would dance well with others.
Right.
But she might get hired because she was plucky. And so what are your, I don't know, like some final words of advice that you could give to somebody who is embarking on this insane journey?
I would say the first thing is, listen to as much music as you can.
Okay.
Play as much music as you can. If you want to take auditions, play for everybody that will listen to you. You need to put yourself in an environment that makes you nervous, whether that's your friends, your colleagues, other cellists. You should play for other instrumentalists because there's going to be more than just cellists on a committee. There's going to be always some other string players, possibly some wind players. Go play for wind players. Go play for anybody that's going to make you feel self-conscious about what you're doing. And take that feedback. But don't just take that feedback. Learn from the experience. What happened to you when you got nervous?
Yeah.
How do you get around feeling nervous? How do you play your best when you're nervous? Because you're going to be nervous anyway. And then I think the other thing that's really important is you have to take care of yourself. Mm. You have to sleep enough. You have to exercise. You can't give all these other things up in pursuit of just practicing the cello. Mm-hmm. You have to live as a full human being. You have to experience life, and you also have to take the best care of yourself so that you can be prepared and do your best in this competition setting.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's like you're not a robot. So you have to, like, in order to be able to do all of those things that you've been talking about, in order to be able to do the technical playing, to play cleanly, but to also have the feel of the music and to have the rhythm, to have all of those things, like, you have to, like, the feeling of music is something that I think you can probably only pick up from knowing what feelings feel like. So yeah. Having like a life outside of music and experiencing things. And I can see where that just sort of like holistic approach is. So do you work that into your teaching? Do you teach people like are you having people do workout regimens, or people training for races and meditating? And like, do you give them this like whole body assignment?
I talk to my students about all other aspects of life too. Uh-huh. My expertise and sort of my niche where I've been teaching, other than working on coaching for orchestra excerpts, yeah, is really middle to high school, getting students ready for college. Mm-hmm. So when you teach a student that's going from middle school to high school that through that horrible age, then they don't want to talk to their parents. But if you can build some trust with a student, then other things come up in life, because it's not just about teaching someone to play the cello. It's, yeah, teaching somebody what discipline is and what it means to be a good person and what it means to do the right thing. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity here for teaching beyond, mm-hmm, just playing an instrument. So I sort of incorporate all of those words of wisdom that I can into a lesson with students, yeah, over time, and build towards that so that they will continue to get that message. Mm-hmm. And sometimes a student will do something that will create a perfect opportunity for you to give them that learning experience. It just, mm-hmm, depends on what happens to them. And yeah, I have to say, Daisha, that you have inspired me.
Oh, excellent.
Through your podcast to start my own podcast, which is part of why I started it. I really enjoyed everything that you've brought forward in your knowledge, and the people and the guests that you've interviewed. It's been great, because even as a professional musician, I find your interviews very compelling and very interesting and fun to listen to.
Thank you so much. That's so kind of you. And awesome that you started your own podcast.
It's something I've wanted to do for a long time. Uh-huh. And it's part of this same mission of trying to teach and, yeah, trying to educate and trying to get information to people, because everybody needs access to information.
Yes. And
there's not a lot of access to information in this space that I've found, as far as podcasts, mm-hmm, and other things. So if I can get teachers and professionals and conductors to come on and just give me 30 minutes of their time and share their pearls of wisdom that normally people have to pay them for, uh-huh, and then put that out there so that everybody can listen to it, then I feel like we're creating a community that's going to help people get, yes, through a profession that's extremely challenging. But you were definitely an inspiration to me, so I wanted to make sure I told you that.
So fabulous. It makes me feel amazing. I couldn't agree with you more. I think that information is just, it's a human right, and creating free access to information is so important. It's what got me into library science, and it's what got me into public radio, and now in podcasting, and I hope it stays free forever. And so I laud you for adding to that, you know, sort of wealth of information that's out there, especially in this like very focused field. Joel, thank you for being on the show. This has been fabulous.
Thank you. It's been great to be as guests. I really appreciate you inviting me.
You know, Listeners, we've learned a lot in this episode about how to prepare to become a symphony cellist, but I wanted to give you one more tool in your training toolbox, some music for your training montage. And donors, this is what you make possible. Thank you. Hey, Joel, thanks for your rhythm there on the cello. All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com to listen to past episodes, connect with us, support the show financially, nudge, and also to buy swag. Don't forget to subscribe to rate and review our show wherever you listen. Thanks today to Joel Dallow for being on the show. Also, listeners, don't forget to check out Joel's podcast, the Cello Sherpa podcast. Thanks to Houston Public Media, the birthplace of Classical Classroom, and also thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.